There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly. Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.
The kid that's like, I don't feel like walking the dogs today. It's like, yeah, let me see you stand outside till 2 o'clock in the morning in subarctic conditions cutting out cod tongues. You know, you feel like such a punk.
Pulled the lever for the parliament, went outside, smoked one. Dude, that thing must have been in there for 20 years. I took like one drag and I think the whole cigarette just went up in flames.
Oh, yeah, come up to Pulaski, man. Everybody's just got mono on their fly reels.
Yeah, I always feel like it's too difficult of a knot.
It's actually pretty easy.
Oh, well, all right. Good morning, degenerate anglers, and welcome to Bent, the fishing podcast that prefers to wet its knots with someone else's saliva before cinching them tight. I'm Joe Cermelli, and that's how you get the COVID.
And I'm Hayden Samak.
Yes, you are. You are still Hayden. Today, how are you feeling better, by the way? You're all over. You're feeling good.
Yeah. Well, you know, like I said, I didn't really end up getting like that sick to begin with.
You don't have the long COVID?
Very thankfully, no, I do not. At least it appears that way. It might drop dead in 10 years, but, you know, I don't.
Yeah, well, yeah. So might we all. Who knows? Anyway, today on the show, let's see, what do we got? We're going to talk about, get this, we got a bar today with its own theme song. Excited about that. And we're going to talk about knots. And everybody loves to talk knots, right? And by the end of this, you might finally get off, and by you, I mean you, Hayden, finally get off the clinch knot I think you use for everything. Isn't that what you do?
It's so easy. I mean, sort of.
It is, but life, you know, sometimes life is hard. Hey, look, you did finally make it back to Montana. Did Phil's announcement last week spark a little more enthusiasm to get back, did it? I enjoyed
once again,
it thoroughly.
Once again, Joe and Ben listeners, here's your weekly reminder that I am, in fact, not high.
Yeah.
I don't know why people won't let this go. Have you guys ever considered, like, I might just be kind of dumb?
No. Don't say that. You're not dumb. You're just special, and that's why we love you. And I hope it never dies. I think we should just keep that one going. You know.
Yeah, man. Yeah, thanks. Yes, I did in fact make it back to Montana.
Yeah. Well, you know, with all those delays and rescheduling, you know, I got to thinking about it, and I'm like, you were here for so much extra time. We probably still could have gotten a fishing trip in. We didn't know that you were going to get stuck, but in hindsight, I'm like, damn, you actually were here with a negative COVID result for like, you know, 3-4 more days than you should have been.
Yeah. Yeah. And the weather was nice. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, relatively speaking. So, we probably could have, but I did get to hit the ice.
I was going to say you did. Yeah. One wish did come true for you. You got, you finally got back out there and back out on the ice this weekend. How was that?
It was good. I got to break out all that shit that 13 sent me.
And beautiful.
It was everything that I'd hoped for and more.
Well, there you go. So now, having actually finally gotten to use it, any favorite piece of 13 fishing gear emerge out of the glorious pile you were sent?
Yeah, I'm going to get into it. Like, you know, I think we'll talk about it a little more in this episode later on. But what we ended up fishing for was mostly like there was this farm pond that we ended up fishing. And so I bought a lot of like the lighter stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there aren't any like walleye or like anything super big in it. But I was fishing one of those little ultralight Omens with like the split grip.
Yeah.
I love that thing, man. It's cool. It's unbelievably sensitive. And so like the blank starts round, right? And then it tapers into like a flat like ribbon of metal. So it's like the tip is super sensitive. It's so you don't have to use one of those. What do you call like those like spring dipper things?
Oh God. Yeah, I know
what you
mean.
What I'm talking about.
I do. I don't know the lingo, but I know exactly what you mean. But yeah, those rods are pretty slick. Like the tip of those rods, it's like a noodle, but it works somehow, especially for smaller light biting fish.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like, you know, it's good for two things, right? You can really see anytime something interacts with your bait. And then also, if you just like move your wrist a touch, it kind of works as like a spring to amplify that. So it gives you like a really nice action. And that rod, because of how it's designed, has some really like, it has some like surprising backbone to it too. I actually hooked into like a fairly sizable brook trout, like, you know, 15 inches, which, you know, for a brook trout is like a great brookie.
Sure.
And man, I licked that thing before it knew it was hooked, you know? So anyhow, the split grip ultralight Omen is a new favorite and I'm a big fan of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I lick a lot of brookies before they know they're hooked. When you do that,
fly
set, they just end up over your shoulder. You know what I mean? On those little streams you like to fish, just like, whoop, oh, he's behind me 20 feet.
Yeah.
Anyway. No,
that's actually not where I thought you were going with that, but yeah.
No, I could have gone in several directions, but I chose that one.
We choose to wet our brookies with other people's saliva too.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Since you've left, it has gotten colder here, but still not cold enough for local safe ice. So I'm not using any of my 13 ice fishing gear, at least not around the way. You know what I'm saying? Maybe a little bit of skim ice that's going to go away when it gets back to 45 this week.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, moving on to those knots. Did you know I'm actually fascinated by fishing knots? And here's why. I think that anglers obsess over them too much, right? Mm. Like in my opinion, there are four, maybe five knots every angler should know, and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. We were joking about me using a clinch knot for everything, and that's not exactly true. But, you know, I think that like people are like, oh, you got to use this for this and this for that and this for – there are a whole bunch of knots that have like different applications, right? But, you know, I don't think that – you know, if you're a saltwater fisherman, you use a series of knots. If you're a trout fisherman,
As I was going to say, right? So it's situational. Now, in my opinion, every angler should know the clinch, palomar, non-slip mono loop, and a uni-to-uni knot splice. And then, like you say, there's outliers. Like if you fly fish for trout, you got to add a blood knot to that. Have to know how to tie that. If you saltwater fish, you should probably be able to tie a spider hitch. Maybe not the bimini twist, but the spider hitch. But what I see happening is these new knots get popularized by the internet, right? On like TikTok and Reels. There's always these little tutorials on tying these crazy knots, which is fine. And new is good. There's nothing wrong with that. But then what happens, I feel like other knots apparently become weaker. It's like, oh, you're still tying the palomar? That's so 2005, dude. You know what I mean? Only knot I use these days is the San Diego Jam. Like, come on, man. A knot that was good 10 years ago is still, for the most part, a good knot, you know?
Yeah, people are too obsessed with knots, man. And, like, here's the thing. If I wanted to spend all my free time tying knots, I'd get into crocheting and not, like, fly fishing.
Exactly.
My, like, kit basically is, like, five-turn clinch. Kids, the improved clinch is f***ing garbage. Don't use it.
Explain yourself. So you don't go back through the loop to make it improve?
Mm-mm. Because here's, like, the thing. That to me, because of how that knot tightens, when you pull it back through, sometimes that loop will close on your tag end before the turns around your main line have like seated themselves.
I get what you're saying.
A lot of times, and this is just for me, you know, I shouldn't say it's garbage for everyone. Man, if you're better at that, I just find that they don't sit as well. And I find that, I guess it kind of, I guess in opening that loop a little bit by bringing your tag end back through, you kind of take some pressure off of it, and I guess it's not cutting in so much, but...
No, I wasn't trying to give you a hard time. It's actually, I was intrigued that you said that because there have been articles written, right, and some other, like, really hardcore anglers that say the same thing. You don't need to go back through the loop.
Yeah,
right?
No, I don't think you need to do that, man. I think it's like a.
Depends. Yeah, I think it depends on what you're tying it with. But my point, what I was going to say was, even though I've read them and I probably think that's right, I can't not do it. I can't I can't not go back through the loop. And I know other fishermen who've read the same thing. They're like, yeah, but I can't do it. I can't not. It just doesn't feel right.
I will say before we move off of this. The only time that I tie it is if I'm using a clinch knot for some reason on like a bigger hook that for some, like I don't want a snell or something like that. Like, so if I'm like bait fishing or whatever, but I'm trying to think of like a good way to wrap this up. If I'm using like, if I'm using a hook with like a heavy gauge wire and I'm tying a clinch knot on it for some reason, I will use the improved clinch because the diameter of like the hook eye, sometimes your regular clinch will slip a little bit.
Well, that's what it all boils down to is diameter, 100%. And matter of fact, you know, if you're doing 20-pound test or heavier, you don't need five turns. Three will do it. And a three-turn clinch on a heavy saltwater leader, no problems there. No problems there. Yeah. Anyway, we'll get off of that now. And I just want to reiterate that it's not that new knots aren't cool or good. It's just that I think we get obsessed with them. And there's one knot in particular that has really blown up in, let's say, the last 5-6 years or so. So we're going to move into actually a very special tackle hacks for a change with Elite Series Bass Pro Carl Jochumson, who was here a while ago, to discuss this knot. And let's see if he sells you on the merits of what I'd consider the second most pain-in-the-ass knot next to the Bimini Twist.
I'm getting hacked.
It's coming from inside the city.
Fight the planet!
Joining us today for Tackle Hacks, Carl Jochumson is here, Bassmaster Elite Series angler. You've been on before for Smooth Moves, reminding everybody you are the first Australian angler to qualify for the Bassmaster Elite Series. Yeah, man, whenever we have a chance to get like a really high caliber bass pro on like yourself, we'd be remiss not to get a tackle hack because, I mean, bass is America's fish. We have a lot of anglers that chase bass. So I'm always so curious to hear tips from guys like yourself that do this for a living with everything on the line, with all the pressure, something that you have in your repertoire, you lean on a lot that can just make Joe Weekend Angler a better bass fisherman, man. The floor is yours, Carl.
Yeah, no doubt. Thanks for having us on. I think the best one for me is, we talked about it before, is the FG knot. And that's a question that I get asked a lot, is braid to leader. What knot to tie? How do you tie it? Should you use straight through fluorocarbon? When do you use braid? But the FG knot sort of eliminates a lot where you can get the best of both worlds. And it's a difficult knot to tie, but if you learn it, it's sort of worth it. And the reason is it's a plait. So a lot of braid leader knots that will be the weakest point in your line. And a lot of people lose, you know, you go out there, spend all that money and to go out and fish, and then you lose that trophy fish or that fish that you've been chasing for the whole time because of a failed knot is not a good feeling. And it happens all the time to so many. So learning a good braid leader knot is key, and being able to use big long leaders when you do. So you kind of get the best of both worlds. You get that stretch and the, allowing the bait to move naturally with a big, long fluorocarbon leader, but then getting the feel and the hook set and everything of having braid and the lightness of braid, you know, the castability and everything that comes along with braid. So the FG knot is a plaited knot that is very thin and long. The fluorocarbon does not turn. It stays straight. So it flies through your guides super smooth. It doesn't catch and break your lure off or just have a one of those ones where you cast and your bait just slams the water, which happens a lot with the leader. It just eliminates that, and it's 100% knot strength. So you get that's not the weakest point in your line anymore. It's actually the strongest point. It's going to break everywhere else. And generally what I found when I started tying it is I had to improve my knot to my lure then because that was where the point was breaking. And so I've done it now to where I don't know where it's going to break when I get snagged. It usually straightens the hook or it breaks somewhere on the lightest part of the leader. or the, you know, usually down near the bait where it's like been roughed up or something like that. So for me, it would be learn that FG knot and a good knot to your bait, and you'd be enjoying fishing braid leader a lot better.
I'm actually really pumped you brought up this knot, because it's an interesting topic. First of all, if I'm not mistaken, it was the Australian anglers that popularized that knot. I mean, I remember like 5-6 years ago in the saltwater scene, nobody was talking about the FG, and all of a sudden, I do a lot of saltwater fishing, you see like that is, everybody will tell you that is now the only knot worth using. Yep. I use it a ton to saltwater fish, like tuna and stuff, but here's my issue with it, and maybe you have a quick add-on to fix this. I love it, but I need to set up all my rods the night before to be out there doing all that plating and crossing over.
Yeah.
But then if something does break, or if I have to do one on the water while we're rocking around in 6-foot seas, I always feel like it's too difficult of a knot to do properly in those conditions. But I know some guys are very good at tying them faster. Like, is there people listening? It's one you got to look up on YouTube, because it's very hard to explain how to tie it. But once they understand that, is there anything that comes to mind that like makes you tie that knot quicker and smoother on the water?
Yeah, it's actually pretty easy. People get too caught up with making it look. They
yeah, f*** you, Joe.
No, easy to explain why well, it takes right. long. Sorry. It's easy to explain why it takes long. But people try and get caught up with making it look pretty, and that's what happens. They want it to look perfect, and they want all the plaits, but the truth is the second that you've done 5 plaits, that's the knot. It's done. Like, all the rest of it is nothing. The knot, the strength of the knot is in those first 5 to 10 plaits.
You guys can have a laugh at my expense, but I'm going to take that to the bank, because when these things first came out, it's like, you have to do 40 cross, and I'm out there with the thing in my mouth for 45 minutes tying on 1 liter.
To have a certain amount, but the knot strength is in those first few plaits. So you get them correct, then just plait it, and then half hitch it to finish it off, and just don't get crazy. They want to do all the different types of ones to make it like look
it's like
perfect.
It's like needle point, and, man, if you watch some of these videos.
And that's the way I do it the night before, but during a tournament, I can tie it as quicker than anyone can tie a knot. Like, I sit on the leader, I pull it up, it's around my fingers, I'm like plaiting it and half hitching it, and I'm winding it up, and I tie it all the time. But the thing what most people don't get is, if you tie it the night before with a 20-foot, 25-foot leader in bass fishing, you won't have to retie the next day, because it won't break. It'll break down near the knot, and you'll be able to retie, and you can retie drop shots and as many as you like, because you can fish a huge long leader and not run out of leader to where you're having to retie like during a tournament. It's rare that I have to tie an FG during a tournament.
That is a fantastic tip from Carl. He knows more about FG knots than I do. So listen to him, learn the knot, and then practice tying it quick, because you cinched that one up right. It is pretty strong.
I definitely didn't spend an hour trying to learn that knot at my desk right after we recorded that.
Oh, I actually know you didn't, because right after that, we were online together and you fired up a tutorial video on the FG on your phone. And as I recall, you watched it for 35 seconds and said, "You guys are such dorks." And by you guys, you must have meant serious anglers that care to know more than your favorite clinch knot. That's the way I interpreted that response.
I did say that. But it was too many steps, man. It's like, again, if I wanted to spend all my time tying knots, I'd get into crochet.
Yeah, see, I waver, right? Like, when it first got popular, I tried it and I liked it. And I actually got made fun of for it. Like, guys on the boat would like give me a hard time, like, you know, insisting that the uni to uni or Alberto knot were, you know, were better braid to leader connections.
I wouldn't know.
I know. But that's okay. But I will say that after that chat with Carl, I'm starting to lean back into it a tiny bit for things I normally wouldn't, right? Like, I only used it in offshore saltwater. But after that talk, I went on that brown trout trip that you missed that we talked about last week. Mm. And I got to thinking about it, and I'm like, why not? You know what I mean? It's not going to hurt. It can't hurt.
Did you do it?
I did because I'm using stick baits and 15-pound leader, because we're angling for big fish.
Did you notice, like, was it smoother?
Well, it's always
smoother. Because that was his whole thing on it, right?
It is smoother to cast, too, right? Yeah. It slides through your guides nice. There was nothing to notice, because I didn't break off but I didn't break off the last time I did it with a different knot. So it's not really something that's like that's tangible, but it's just I don't know, maybe that little bit more confidence that like if a, you know, 30 inch brown comes out and tanks that, it's not going to snap it off with the connection. It is a very, very solid knot, you know.
Right. And regardless, you know, tying a, most of the time, if you know how to do it, tying a more complicated knot is not going to hurt. Yeah, right. It couldn't possibly hurt unless you were to tie it wrong,
right,
which I probably would. But what is going to hurt is me crushing you, Joe, in this week's installment of Fish News.
Fish News!
That escalated quickly.
So before we kick in the news, I just want to say that we got some really nice notes about the Bent helpline. And just wanted to thank you guys again for so many great questions. And I did, you know, we mentioned when we kicked it off that we've gotten a ton, right? And we're not going to get to all of them. But I did just want to read a few very quickly from Neil Anglin. Okay, he wrote in with like a laundry list of questions. And the only reason I'm doing this is because these are ones that will absolutely not make a Bent helpline segment. Like there's not a chance, but they're still fun and I appreciate them. So Neil asks, who's more punk, Gigi Allen or Lemmy?
Gigi Allen.
Now, why?
Well, okay. Do you really want my like longhand answer on this or you want it like short and sweet?
Short and sweet, please.
Well, Gigi Allen did what Iggy Pop meant to do with the peanut butter.
Right.
If you guys know Gigi Allen, you'll know what I mean there.
Yeah, Gigi Allen was famous for like taking a poop on stage and throwing it at the audience and like smearing himself with it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Lemmy, on the other hand, was initially in a band called Hawkwind. And Hawkwind was like more like of a psychedelic sort of bent.
Yeah.
Lemmy decided that he didn't fit in with like a lot of those philosophies, famously saying that he had some proclivities that were not in line with the exact proclivities or habits of Hawkwind. And so he left and made Motorhead.
Okay.
Punk in two ways. Punk in two ways, but I still have to go with Gigi Allen. Although for all you Gigi Allen fans, he was a terrible, trash human being, and it is very hard to say anything good about him other than perhaps he embodied a certain ethos.
I was not expecting this to generate this much conversation. I'm very surprised. It's great, though. So my answer would be in terms of, like, who is more punk? Yes, it's Gigi Allen. Like, he sort of lived the punk lifestyle more. But his music was terrible. Yeah. Like, you're not singing Gigi Allen in the shower. You know,
well,
I mean, I'll
Sid
sing
Vicious
some Motorhead.
Was terrible.
Yeah, he was a
you
terrible
know what I mean?
Bass
like,
player. But, yeah, you're right. Let's move on. Next
okay,
question
yeah.
from Neil. Did Miles ever purchase a record player? How the f*** should I know? I have no idea if Miles ever bought a record player. You'd have to ask Miles. And his final one here, Bob the Garbage Man owes me some stickers. Can I send you some smokes so you can trade him? He hasn't picked up the payphone number he gave me. That's between you and Bob and the Better Business Bureau, my friend.
Man,
I don't
you should
know.
Try and get his burner number instead.
Exact burner number. But yeah, so it just goes to kind of show you the range of questions we've been getting. They're all super fun. But I don't think we could do a full segment on Gigi Allen. I actually think we already kind of did too much.
Yeah,
you know what I'm
yeah.
saying? Point is, we're really having fun with this. Also, just want to say sorry to all the people that wrote in and said, I didn't notice the Bass Pro trucker hat thing, and now I notice them everywhere. Thanks for officially ruining those.
Yeah.
Although,
well, you know, it wasn't us.
It
wasn't us, man. what we can officially ruin, however, is Phil's day by making him listen to our shit and judge our news stories. Remember, this is Fish News. It's a competition. Joe and I do not know which news story the other guy has grabbed. And our beloved, beloved audio engineer, Phil Taylor, will declare a winner at the end. And Joe, I believe it's your lead this week.
I believe it is, too. So I'm going to open with a question before I get into this news story. What was your very first job as a kid? Like, you know, like kid, like paperboy era, that type of thing. What was your first
well,
gig?
Well, I was a paperboy in a slightly different bent. My dad had a printing business. It's since, like, changed into something else. But I used to work in the bindery department of that business, meaning
ah.
I would like shrink wrap and spiral bind things. And I still have nightmares about it to this day. I remember one time I did this, I shrink wrapped this huge stack of hospital like forms, right? Mm-hmm. And after doing that all day, this dude Ryan came in with a stack of yellow papers and he said, I forgot to put these on top of each one of these things that you just did. You need to unwrap all of them, put this paper on top, and then rewrap all of them again. So
and you that punched him in the face and got fired.
No, I kind of just did as I was told, like a good little droid.
Yeah.
So that was my first job.
Okay. All right. There you go. So I walked dogs. Mm. That was my first job. There was a lady across the street that would pay me $20 a week to walk her dogs when I got home from school. And it took me about a week of doing it to not feel like doing it anymore. Like in hindsight, how lazy, like it's a walk around the block. But I didn't feel like it anyway.
I feel like you could have gotten a little bit more than $20. But this was in like the 40s, so.
No, it was 1974, actually. Yeah, right, exactly. I was like a millionaire kid. So anyway, look, so now that everyone listening is reminiscing about their first kitty job, I'd bet that none of them can top tongue cutter, okay? So Smithsonian recently published a terrific piece about child tongue cutters in Norway. And the tongues they are cutting are cod tongues. But as I explain this, I want all of you that have children in like the 6 to 13-year-old range to decide, yes, my kid could hack it, or hell no. Okay, so you recently covered the reassessment of the cod stocks in the U.S., right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
But over in Norway, there seems to be a lot more of them. Those are some of the breeding grounds for the stocks over there. And the commercial cod fishing is still major business. Yeah. So this story is set in, it's either Ryne or Ryne, probably Ryne, which is a town in Norway's Lofoten Islands. I'm doing the thing that you do where I can't say stuff. And this is of course well north of the Arctic Circle, right? So there's several cod processing plants there, and at the processors, the cod bodies are dried, frozen, or salted, and then exported for food. Now, according to this story, a cod tongue is squishy, gelatinous, and buttery smooth, and likened to the filet mignon of the cod, which I'd never heard before. If that's a thing that we do here, I've never heard of it.
It's like when somebody tells me about, like, I don't know, cooking, like, perch cheeks or some shit. I'm like, well, how much meat is there? How big is a cod tongue?
I think cod tongues are pretty large, but all I can think of is those stories that are floating around that nobody grabbed for news about those parasites that just replace a fish's tongue. Like, that's all I could think about. Like,
we should have grabbed that, huh?
I know. The idea of eating a fish tongue, not super appealing. Anyway, so the thing about this is removing them is tedious, and the processing plants just can't make quite enough money off of them to make the tongue removal worth their time. So instead, they set aside all the cod heads for the local kids, many of which show up after school routinely to remove tongues and sell them on their own. Now, the processors know that they are leaving some money on the table, but these kids known as, I'm going to try really hard here, and I'm only going to do it once.
I love this.
Tungus Yarnin. That's fine. Which translates to tongue cutters, and that's what we're going to say for the rest of the time. This is not something new. The people growing up in this region, kids have been doing this for generations. And the processors gladly donate the heads because it, quote, introduces young people to the fishing industry and teaches them the value of entrepreneurship and hard work. And hard work it is. Per the story, right, I love this quote, this job makes selling Girl Scout cookies or running a lemonade stand look like child's play, right? Now, it goes on. I want to read from the story. It's very well written.
Uh-huh.
That children as young as 6 go straight from school to the docks where they spend hours in the numbing cold coated in fish guts, sharp knives in hand, may seem bizarre when viewed from the perspective of today's developed economies and increasingly virtual workplaces. But the rarefied nature of this work, proudly undertaken by kids who feel a connection to the tradition, is part of what makes the practice so fascinating. So it says the task itself involves spearing the head onto a giant metal spike and then slicing out the tongue. And the tongues pile up on the spike until they reach the top, where they're then tossed into a bucket, right?
Okay.
And the author says the kids' handiwork was so quick it was difficult to make out the distinct steps. Heads were grabbed, spiked, sliced, tossed, grabbed, spiked, sliced, tossed, until the large bin was empty and a new batch of cod heads arrived. Despite harsh winds and below freezing temperatures, a few of the older tongue cutters who worked fast were sweating. Piles of snow were pink with blood, but they didn't seem to mind, right? So there's more to it than that, though. So they interviewed a local fish exporter, and he was like, yeah, like back in the day, I'd let my six-year-old stay out there till midnight sometimes cutting these tongues. But then after these kids are done, then they have to go home, wash their own tongues, weigh them out, right, separate them, package them, and freeze them. And these don't get exported. These are mostly sold locally. So they interviewed several generations of cutters. One is now a mother of kids who cut. She says when she was a young girl, she made $32,000 over the course of six seasons and used that to buy her first car.
Wow.
Nowadays, some of these kids are earning more than $10,000 in a single season. Right?
Good for them, man.
Yeah, right? And they talked to a 14-year-old girl who basically said, I don't want to talk about how much I make because it's a lot.
Yeah.
I just don't want people to know.
That is the most gangster 14-year-old girl. She's like, yo, mind your own f***ing business, son.
Yeah, exactly, right? So it says, you know, she used her earnings most recently to buy a new iPhone and Apple AirPods so she could listen to music while she cut. And apparently these kids all use a mobile app called Marine Traffic to see when the boats are headed back to the dock. And then they sell their tongues now on like Facebook Marketplace and stuff, which some of the older people kind of said, you know, they say like that sort of takes away the charm of what it used to be, like, you know, the little kid selling tongues. Now it's like it's a business. Now, look, there's a lot of crafty, hardworking kids out there in all countries, no doubt. It's not the racket and the hustle that I find so special, interesting, but it's the conditions. Like some of these kids will stay out there until 2 o'clock in the morning cutting tongues in just brutal conditions. And I fully understand that these kids are used to those conditions, yeah. Right? That's where they grew up. But still, like we had, you know, 3 inches of snow here the other day, and my little guy, who's like the hardcore fisherman, he's outside for 10 minutes, was like, yeah, I'm cold. And then declined participation in all outdoor activities for the remainder of the day. So good on these kids. That is impressive. And like for the kid that's like, I don't feel like walking the dogs today. It's like, yeah, let me see you stand outside till 2 o'clock in the morning in subarctic conditions, cutting out cod tongues, you know, yeah. I feel like such a punk.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, man, it's a different breed up there, man. Those fishing cultures. I mean, you see this in a lot of like cultures that rely on like fishing or like agrarian or just what have you. It kind of like just breeds this certain type of person that is just impervious to a lot of the stuff that like us soft you know?
Yeah, sure. No, and that's exactly right. And I mean, that's what I mean. I don't want to make it sound like, you know, kids in the U.S. don't know how to work hard. You have kids whose parents own ranches and grow up in, you know, working farms and everything. I'm saying, though, like the impression I get is that none of these kids need to do this to survive. It's not like they're feeding their families.
Right.
This
right.
is basically for walking around money. And rather than do what normal 6 to 13 or 14 year olds would do after school, like they're opting into this. And that is badass. Like those are some tough ass kids. You know what I mean?
Please enter your password. You have one unheard message.
Mr. Samak, I have been meaning to call you and give you shit. Like, you really do need to, like, do some basic fucking research when you're doing a news story on, I don't know, Turkish names, maybe, on pronunciation. And Recep Tayyip Erdogan? Dude, that's the fucking, that is the president of Turkey. It's not like an obscure name. That is actually the current president of Turkey. You should have got that one, buddy. Anyhow, we'll catch up soon. Be well.
End of message. Delete. Press 7. Save. Deleted.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at OReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's OReillyAuto.com/meateater. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today. Because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Phil, if I were you, I would pick Joe as the winner here.
That's never good when you cross over like that.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I do think that I have at least a contender here. I wanted to talk to you, Joe, about a we need to talk, buddy. I wanted to talk about a poaching incident that's getting a lot of coverage. And in fact, this comes from USA Today, which is an interesting source to like cover like an outdoor story, right?
Well, they only tend to do it when it's pretty big and powerful to get there. They also have that side site called For the Win.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've read a lot of good things off there. Anyway, yeah. Go ahead.
Anyway, good for you, USA Today. This December, Corporal Brian Talent of Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fish, and Parks busted two folks who were caught with 152 crappie over their legal limit. Ooh. While fishing in Mississippi's Eden Reservoir, or the spillway, I guess, to Mississippi's Eden Reservoir. The limit would have been 30 between the two of them. So for those of you who can't do math, that's 182 crappie, which is a crap ton of crappie. You like that?
I do like that. Oh, man. I mean, you know, these things pop up every once in a while. It's not the first time, and I'm never less flabbergasted over just how far, you know, some people are willing to go over the limit. That's a big one, though. That's a big one for a couple guys.
Yeah, yeah. It's basically a truck bed full of crappie.
Yeah.
Now, the story is pretty, like, lacking in details. I tried doing more research online and was just, like, looking. It was basically the same story copied and pasted just over and over again. And that's really all the information that was there. This person busted these people, and these people had this many fish, and now these people are in trouble. Doesn't name the anglers, doesn't talk about the method of take, doesn't talk about penalties, nothing.
That's interesting. Okay. That's fairly rare. They don't get a little bit more detail there, for sure.
So I put on my investigative journalist hat and got on the horn with MDFWP.
Ooh, phoning it in. All right. I'm impressed.
Yeah. Well, you know, I like to do that every now and again. Keep the people informed.
Phil should factor that kind of stuff in, by the way.
He really should.
I hope he does.
Phil, put a check mark there.
Extra effort. No matter what you're about to say or where this goes, like, extra, more effort than I.
And everybody hung up on me the end. anyway, it turned out there was a lot I didn't know about the fishery itself. And I think that information really clears up a lot of the questions surrounding the story. So first, let's talk a little bit about crappie fishing in Mississippi. Joe, we both know that when you get into crappie, you like really get into them.
Yeah. I mean, it's fairly rare to catch one crappie. If you catch one, you've typically found them all, or at least a handful more. So, yeah.
Yeah, and that's just up north. Southern crappie is a whole different ballgame.
It's also big business. I think it's worth pointing out that, Mississippi, Alabama, northern Alabama in particular. I've fished in center Alabama, which claims to be the crappie capital of the U.S., yeah, I feel like by and large, in especially in the Northeast, it's something that's there that you get into on occasion, but there's not the same kind of culture around it that there is in this area.
Yeah. So, again, it's a whole different ballgame, and it's a whole different ballgame in, more ways than one. For instance, Joe, did you know that you could snag crappie in Mississippi?
Legally?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. No, I did not.
Yeah, so there are spillways across the state where the crappie congregate as temperatures drop in the winter, and it is perfectly legal to snag those fish. In fact, one person I talked to mentioned that there are even plaques at these spillways detailing exactly how one can legally go about it. It's one pole per angler, a maximum of two hooks, no bigger than a number two, and no less than an inch apart. And no treble hooks at all.
Wow, man. I mean, yeah, that's totally news to me. I had no idea. Usually with any kind of game fish, I thought there was no snagging of it.
Right. Yeah. So I mean, we know when you get onto them, it's easy fishing, but even then, 152 over the limit seems like gill net numbers. And the first thing I thought of was, how the hell do they do that? Well, there's your answer. They were snagging, which is legal, although I wouldn't be surprised if they weren't, abiding by that rule while they were completely ignoring their limit. I wouldn't be surprised if they were are these hooks more than an inch? You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. I mean, I also wouldn't be surprised if they overlooked the two hook limit, on the lines there. But what's interesting to me, I don't know. It seems like if there's a rule in place like this, right, where this is legal or at a certain time of year or when the crappie are doing this, typically I feel like states would put those rules into play because a fair amount of people actually want to take them that way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I don't know all the details, but it would seem to me like if that's a thing that people do, so much so that there's rules in play, nobody else was down at this particular spot seeing this happen. I mean, they couldn't have snagged that many fish in 10 minutes, or maybe they could. Maybe there's so many in there and they put nine hooks on their line.
Yeah.
Who knows? But I wonder about that.
Yeah. Well, that is part of the story that I couldn't find out is exactly how this got reported, but it did get reported by the public. Somebody said suspicious activities going on here.
Got it.
You might
want
to check it out. So I don't know exactly what that entailed, but that's what happened. So, the guys got busted, which begs the question, what does the fine for being 152 fish over your legal limit look like? According to the MWFP's law enforcement office, the fine for the infraction is $500 to $1,000. That's your base fine, with an additional fine of $25 to $100 per fish over the limit. That means, as I understand it, the poachers are facing the potential for a combined $16,200, approximately half of the 14-year-old girl's tongue cutter money in fines for being for being crappie hogging dumbasses.
Yeah, well, and I applaud the state for their $25 to $100 per fish over. I mean,
they're not going to get that.
Well, that's the thing, man. You see a lot of states really go for the throat and try and set an example here. That might do something to scare off the next group of guys. We've discussed that here before, where just because that's a penalty, it doesn't mean they're going to pay it. And, in my opinion, if you're that much of a jerk ass to do something like this in the first place, somebody could take your license away or whatever. You're going to do it. If this is what you do, if you have it in you once, chances are you're going to do it again no matter what gets imposed on you. Just my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I hope they throw the book at him. Anyway, the next thing I wanted to know is what the hell happens to all these fish. So an employee for MDFWP's Northern Regional Office, and you'll notice that, like, I've left this particular person's name out of this news story.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were going to name drop.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm honestly pretty sure I was annoying that guy, so I didn't, like, ask for a lot of follow-up. And, in fact, I didn't even, like, get his – I didn't even want to ask him for his name again because I was getting pretty curt answers at this point.
Were you just saying, yeah, man, a lot? Is that what the problem
man.
Was?
Yeah, man. So that guy, he intimated to me that it was up to the officer's discretion, like, what happened to these fish, meaning that the officer could basically transfer the fish wherever he wanted to.
Right.
I used the example of a food bank, which he said would have been possible if the officer had deemed it appropriate. So he saw, like, these fish were all good. They were in good condition. Sure, let's give them to the food bank, right?
Right.
So, you know, let's hope that that's where they ended up and not in, like, the landfill. I would also accept that officer hosting a badass fish fry, though.
Yeah, if it's at his discretion, man, party at his joint. You know what I mean? That's not a terrible idea. That's not a terrible idea.
No. So, finally, I was interested in, like, the frequency of which things like this happen. The aforementioned guy, I'm pretty sure I was annoying, said that it happens all the time. But he did, in a shocking turn of events, he didn't voluntarily, like, start listing off some specifics. So I followed up with Major Chris Reed in the MDFWP's Central Region Office. While snagging over their limit does happen occasionally, he said, he also noted that this event was particularly egregious. He said that in 16 years, I haven't checked anyone that's been that brazenly over the limit. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but that's why we're out here checking, to make sure the resources don't get depleted in this way. I've never seen 150-ish fish over the limit.
Yeah, and some of that stuff is going to sneak by. I think, it's not easy being a conservation officer in any state now. You know what I mean? There's only so many of you. You can't be anywhere. So, I mean, even this bust, I think, you know, should at least help to alleviate some of this and at least, you know, scare some people, I would hope. That's kind of what all you could hope for with a lot of these outcomes.
Yeah. Yeah, is to, you know, be taking a portion of these incidents, making them an example, and trying to dissuade others from participating in just bullshit like this themselves. So, anyhow, guys, don't be a crappie-catching shithead. I'd also like to thank Corporal Brian Talent for protecting the resource and everybody at MDWFP who took the time to talk to me, even the guy who was very obviously annoyed with my line of questioning.
Well, I still applaud you for calling. And let's see who Phil's going to applaud. Is it crappie catching shitheads or the lovely, you know, beautiful children of Norway who are up there cutting cod tongues while we, live the lavish life down here? We're going to find out who wins. We're going to hear from Phil. And then we're going to go have a drink in a Yinzer establishment, if you know what that means.
I don't really open up about my process very often on this podcast, but I'm going to be honest with you. I'm kind of tired of poaching stories, and unless it involves someone named The Breeze, I'm also getting a little sick of record stories. So, Hayden, I commend you hitting the pavement for this story, but I gotta give it to Joe this week. I wonder if Gigi Allen knew about these Norwegian kids. He could have invited them up to cut cod tongues out on stage as his opener. That would have been punk as hell.
Best goddamn bartender from Timbuktu to Portland, Maine. Or Portland, Oregon, for that matter.
So where are we going for some suds this week? Yinzer country. How about that?
Mm.
Western PA. You ever spend any time out there?
I went to visit Carnegie Mellon one time, and that is the extent of my travels to Pittsburgh.
My wife actually applied there and checked that out too. Ended up not going, passed on that.
I did not get in.
I wasn't even going to do it. You did it to yourself. So I've done some catfishing in the Berg, literally right in front of the stadium. And that was cool. And that was with my old buddy, Joe Gordon of the Three Rivers Catfish Club. I've also done some musky fishing on the Allegheny, but I've never been out there for trout. And there is some damn fine trout water out that way. In fact, some of it runs directly behind this week's drinking establishment, which was submitted by listener Matt Wagner.
Right. So the official name of this place is the Halton Sportsman's Lodge. But according to Matt, everybody knows it as the Halton Hilton.
Which is
really Here's great. How Matt opens up this fantastic nomination.
It's so good.
As a young man, I dreamed of having a beer in the famed Halton Hilton. This bar has a storied past and is really a cultural staple in the Allegheny National Forest. My family has had a camp in Halton since the mid-1950s, and the Halton Hilton was established in the late 50s. It's located in Elk County, Pennsylvania, south of Ridgeway on the banks of the Clarion River. My father and I caught some beautiful trout from the hole directly across the bar, and at the end of the day, enjoyed plenty of straw beers before heading back to camp. According to relatives, people just started calling it the Halton Hilton, and the name stuck. People come from miles around to check this place out, and it has almost become a rite of passage to have a straw and a, quote, belly buster.
Belly buster, right? So let's get into that. So Matt continues, right? This place is famous for its belly buster burger. The burgers were rumored to be part venison and are actually quite delicious. I mean, where else can you go and get a lukewarm straw and pickled turkey gizzards? The restrooms were an adventure in themselves. And sure. At one point, the men's room was just a hole in the floor. He says, the St. Pauli girl cardboard cutout and the old school cigarette machine. And then in parentheses, he says, you know the style that had the knob you pulled and the smokes came out? Ask Joe. He has definitely bought cigs from one of these. I'll comment on that in a minute. Gave this place its own kind of nostalgia. Then when you looked up, you knew you were in an awesome place. Painted on the ceiling is a giant black silhouette of a flying goose and velvet wallpaper covered the walls. So yes, I do know those SIG machines. And I think I bought a pack from one in college exactly once, because I kid you not, I turned 21 and within 2 months you couldn't smoke in bars anymore around here. And those cigarette machines just totally disappeared. Right? Yeah.
Well, and dear listener, I have also bought cigs from one of those machines.
Really?
Yeah, there used to be this spot in Manayunk that I played called the Grape Room. I used to like play music there a bunch. And they had one of those old school cig machines.
It's like a foosball table, man. They're badass. Yep.
And one day I was like, I need some cigs. I don't feel like walking to the convenience store. I'm here right now. Let's see if it has anything in it. So I put my money in, pulled the lever for the Parliaments, and out came a nice little pack of Parliaments. Went outside, smoked one. Dude, that thing must have been in there for 20 years.
Dude, you know what, too? Like, I remember it was
one drag, and I think the whole cigarette just went up in flames.
As I recall, too, they only really could give you soft packs, which, like, sucked. Like, soft packs suck.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
always get crushed.
If you want a way to break all your cigs at once, man, put a soft pack in your pocket and go do anything.
Anything, right. Kids, don't smoke. Stop listening to us if you're listening right now.
I don't smoke anymore.
I don't. Me either. Anyway, regarding the belly buster, I got to say, now that sounds epic. And I'm going to prime the pump here for hate mail. But I don't care, because I've had this debate privately with many Yinzer buddies, and it's time to take it public. So I'm a Philly guy, right? And I will put my Tony Luke's, Steve's Prince of Steaks, and Geno's against that Permane's nonsense
trash
that you guys eat out there. Okay, the first time I was in Pittsburgh, I couldn't get to the famous Permane Brothers fast enough, and I'm sorry, I didn't think it was that good. Right, their whole shtick is loading the sandwich with French fries, so to me, I just tasted like white bread and French fries. I didn't understand. So next time I'm out that way, belly buster all day. That sounds amazing.
Now, real quick, I did say trash. And I wasn't talking about Permanente's. I was talking about Geno's and, what did you say, Tony Luke, Steve's, Prince of Steaks. I'm disappointed in you, bro.
What's your spot?
No, you got to go to Chubby's, man.
I don't think I've ever been to Chubby's. I've never even heard of Chubby's.
Chubby's, that's in, like, East Falls, man. That's, like, That's where it's really at. You go do some catfishing this summer, then go up by the Philly U campus, or I guess it's Jefferson now, and go get one of those chubbies, man. You'll be happy you did. So anyway, on from me ragging on you for your cheesesteak choice. So Matt moves into the history and the characters you might find at the Halton Hilton. All great bars have a character or two. He says, John Hanley bought the bar from his parents in 1964 and was the proprietor there until his death in 2015. He was always there to talk to people and provide some of his perspective, at least when he wasn't in his pickup parked next to the building. I like this guy.
Yeah.
John was a local legend and spoke in his own special dialect. He held the history of the Halton close to his heart and would willingly produce some of the old photos from the area and had stories to tell about every one of them. Some of his most loyal customers, the folks that he served for years, described him as quiet, honest, and honorable.
Quiet, honest, and honorable. I fit that bill except for quiet. So to bring it home and to get to the best part, right? Matt says that upon John's death, his niece took the place over and updated it a bit. And as he put it, he'd actually bring his wife there now. And that's cool. Hmm. But that's also like a slippery slope because I know a few good bars that lost their magic after renovation. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
The hole in the floor and the pisser kind of made it, you know, what it was. And I hope that's not the case at the Hilton. But here's what really sealed the deal on including the Halton Hilton. With this nomination, Matt sent along a link to the official Halton Hilton song. Yes, the place has its own song. And while I wish we had time to play the whole thing, we don't. But really, you'll get it with just the first 30 seconds.
Way up in old Elk County, there's a town by the name of Halton, where the creeks run clear and the clearing flows on by. There's a place where they do their meeting, have a drink and do some eating, where the gossip's thin and you'll never hear a lie. It was hot and I was a wilting, so I headed for the Hilton to have a beer and a burger and some fries. It was built in the days of Custer, and it's a home of the Belly Buster, and I'll visit it again before I die.
Yo, I've never visited a bar that had its own theme song.
Me either. And me either, man.
I thought that was like reserved for Cheers. I don't know who's singing that, but I want to hang out with that dude. I want to soak Shiner with him.
You know who it might be? It might be The Breeze, the guy that caught the PA state record walleye. Like, dude. How much you want to bet the Breeze has like swigged some bourbon at the Halton Hilton, right? He's from those parts. Anyway, Matt, thank you so much for a great nomination. This was a lot of fun. The theme song was amazing. And if you've got a fishy bar with or without a theme song that you'd like us to consider for a shout out here, send the deets to bent@themeateater.com. So since we just got done talking, drinking, I got to ask, right? You posted some ice fishing videos on the gram from that little soiree, and I couldn't help but notice that a sketchy brown, like an old school bootlegger flip cap bottle kept making an appearance. Was that homemade hooch? Because that's what it looked like.
In fact, some homemade hooch.
Atta boy.
Yeah, no, that was my very last bottle of a run of dandelion wine I made right around when the pandemic first hit. So like April or May of 2020. And you know, I was out with Miles, actually. He came with me. It was me, Miles, my girlfriend.
Miles Nolte?
Miles Nolte. Yeah. Miles Kidd and Christine, my buddy from the office here. And we all caught a couple perch and a nice buzz because of it, except for Miles. Miles was he's doing one of those dry January things, so I couldn't get him to try it.
Okay, well, you know what, did you write a story about that, about dandelion wine? Now I'm thinking about it, wasn't there something on the Meat Eater site that you put together about how you made that?
I did. Yeah, I'll put the link in my IG bio for anyone that's interested. It's a fun little project I do like every year or two. I will say it is a royal pain in the ass because, like, in order to make it, like, the first thing you have to do is, I'm going to go through like a real quick explanation of the tediousness of this process, is that you go to a field, right? Make sure like it's not a dog park because they piss on the dandelions, or like, you know, don't get in front of a bank where they're like spraying them with like, you know, Roundup.
Yeah.
But you pick like buckets, like a 10-gallon bucket full of dandelions, or like halfway full. And then you take them home and you pull the petals off of the little green cup that holds them all together. It's called the sepal. Mm-hmm. So you pull all the petals and you put them in a pot until you have like a full pot full of dandelion petals. Because if you put the green shit in, it's going to make them real bitter.
Oh, that sounds excruciating.
It's something you do when you have some time, like in the middle of a pandemic.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I love it. When you have that, when you get everything all said and done and it's aged and it's like, it feels like drinking like springtime or some shit, you know?
That's like such an... It's like an Andrew Zimmern thing to say. Like, it tastes like grass coated in rainwater on a full moon night.
I would say it's more Bourdain-esque, but, you know, whatever. I'm not a wine snob. In fact, I tend not to like wine. I just happen to like this.
Yeah.
You would like bizarre foods. Anyhow, I don't know. It's a dead of winter, and you have this thing you made a couple springs ago. It's like, I don't know. I like that.
Yeah. Well, you can explain it more later. People can read the piece. But right now, we have some other more pressing things to explain. Let's wrap things up with our new segment, The Bent Helpline, where we answer your questions. And this week, we even have a special guest.
What are you laughing at, Martini?
You're not an idiot,
huh? You're not a damn loony now, boy. You're a fisherman.
Bent! What's your emergency?
So we've got a very special edition of the Bent Helpline today. We've actually called in reinforcements to answer one of your questions. We're joined today by my good friend Jim Fee of On the Water magazine, who was a co-host here before Hayden signed on full time. Jim, how art thou?
Good, good. That was great.
How's it feel to be here as an expert in a specific faction of fishing? People don't even know what we're talking about yet, but you're the man. You're the guy.
Oh, yeah. I feel like I've earned it. So
yeah. Okay, so, you know, now that you mention it. So here's what we're talking about. This question comes to us from listener Ryan Foster. And he says, I am curious about float and fly technique. Have you guys used it, and how'd it work out? What's the setup you used? Is it a bent approved technique? And then he says, I feel dirty watching these videos on it being a fly angler, but I am not a complete fly guy. Okay, so he dabbles in other arenas. I like to fish and catch fish. I think we all can agree on that, Ryan. Mm-hmm. Thanks, and keep up the good work, guys. So this is the thing. I know what float and fly is. I get the premise, but I don't do it. Yet Jim here, on a weekly basis in the winter months, is just like, you are the float and fly guy on Instagram. You do this a lot. So I'm like, we just got to call Jim because he does this all the time. So rather than me like make shit up about what I think I know, right, which might not be anything, can you explain to us what float and fly technique is?
Yeah, so I first read about it, man, probably in the late 90s in an In Fisherman magazine article. Mm. And it was real big for smallmouth bass in moving water. It was really big for them in the springtime. Also, it's what I use it for is in the cold water months.
So that's one of the things I think I know. It is a cold, like it shines in the off season in cold, cold water, right?
So all you're doing is suspending a hair jig under a float. And they're usually tied with kind of synthetic material. So they're going to have a lot of kind of breathing and action as that jig just suspends under the float. And it's kind of fallen out of favor. Like, I don't think it's a modern technique that guys are really into. Maybe it's coming back around again. It seems like all those things come back around. But Ned rigs now are like, that's all I hear about is guys using in the winter.
In the wintertime, Ned rigging in the wintertime. So, yeah, so that's, again, not the expert here, but that was the impression I got. Like, it's specifically for suspended fish in cold water. And it's not super aggressive, right? Like, you're kind of just like letting the fly breathe and it's just hanging in their face or the jig. That's the other misconception. It's called float and fly. You just said, though, it's a jig. You're not actually hanging a fly under the bobber.
Yeah, it's a hair jig on either a 1/8 or 1/16 ounce jig heads. Those are the most popular sizes. So it's a pretty small presentation. But even though it's small, I mean, people have caught 7-8 pound largemouth bass on it. It's really good for, you know, smallmouth bass, 4 or 5 pounds. I haven't caught a 7 or 8 pound largemouth on it, but I've gotten them in excess of 5 pounds on it.
Right, but it was sort of developed for moving water, but yet you're using it in still water, right, up in Massachusetts.
Yeah, I'm using it in the ponds here. You know, I live on the coast on Cape Cod, so we don't get ice every year. Right. But those ponds are still full of fish, and there's great largemouth bass fishing there. You can fish suspending jerk baits, or I like this technique because, one, it works really well in cold water, and I'm using a real long, like, ultralight noodle rod to throw it because you need a little extra length to, one, right, not only cast, like, the, you know, the long leader,
yeah,
but also you're fishing it still, so you're going to have a lot of slack on the water. So you want to be able to have a lot of room to lift to set the hook when that goes down at the end of your cast. So,
is there, like, a specialized float or something, or it's just, like, your run-of-the-mill slip bobber?
So serious bass guys that are on bass boats and have a lot of backcast room are using fixed floats. So they know they're sending it to the same depth, you know, 9-foot rods. I'm doing it from shore or from my kayak mostly. So I use a little slip float. And that one's called the Thill Wobble Bobber. The whole idea is it's a teardrop shaped float. And it has written on it, you know, this one will work best with a 1/8 ounce jig. So it's like you're setting up for center pin fishing where the floats are meant to suspend a certain amount of weight. And the wobble bobber, the idea behind it, it's not just fun to say, but it, when you have wind or waves, it throws some action. It really does wobble all over the surface, gives a little bit more very subtle action to the jig.
That's what I was going to ask. Like, I imagine at some point you have to work it, and at some point if you have a chop, like, especially when it's cold, you probably get smashed just letting that thing bob around out there, right?
If you cast it near fish, you can't pause it for long enough. The problem is, it's long pause. You have to know where the fish are. It is not a search presentation.
Right, right. Gotcha. Well, I mean, without even knowing all that, I already knew it was a Ben-approved technique because, to me, there's no unapproved technique here barring, I don't know, throwing a spear at him or something. Or snagging
Look, we have listeners who are spearfishing. In fact, if you look, I'm wearing a spearfishing hoodie right now from my buddy Ryan Ebert. So,
well, that's a specialized thing to the guys. That's cool. And if like,
you
if said you're
spear,
man enough,
not me, man.
Okay, fine, whatever, whatever. So I hope that answers Ryan's question because I assume that's the float and fly he's talking about. The only other thing that comes to mind are like those casting bubbles you can put on your spinning rod to dry fly. Jim's like, I am about that too. I never pick up a fly rod.
I want to get into that. That is another. That's also big up here. Where it's the clear casting bubbles, and you like fill them up with a little bit of water, and then the guys up here will fish like woolly buggers. I've seen guys use the floating Berkeley power worms behind them, and that is really good for trout. But I haven't dabbled in that yet. Yep. But that's like a trout technique. That kind of casting bubble and fly. Like you said, if you're just determined not to use a fly rod.
Yeah. And then that's also like kind of similar to like, Joe, you and I talked a little bit about like, you know, people fishing with flies using noodle rods on like the Great Lakes steelhead scene.
Yeah. I mean, I've thrown a lot of flies for steelhead on long conventional noodle spinning rods with and without floats for steelhead. I don't know. I don't find any of that dirty.
Yeah.
It's all just, it just works. It's just a different kind of presentation.
No, and then the other good thing is like your guides don't ice up as bad in like the middle of winter because you're not like sending that big thick fly line through them and getting them all wet.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Come up to Pulaski, man. Everybody's just got mono on their fly reels.
Oh, sure.
Dude, tell me about it. Tell me about it. That. Yeah. There's not even fly line. Well, I am so glad that I had a float and fly expert to call for this.
I'm a float and fly enthusiast, Joe.
Enthusiast. Editor-in-chief of Float and Fly Monthly. But, I mean, I can tell you, Ryan, that even though I haven't done it, I'd like to, but it absolutely does work because, like, you know, I'm sitting here staring at a computer and Jim's posting his morning float and fly session photos and catching a lot of fish. So, Jim, thank you for that. Ryan, thank you for the question. If you've got a question you'd like us to maybe answer here on the show, you can DM them to me on the Instagram or Hayden, or just go ahead and fire those off to bent@themeateater.com. All right. Well, that's it for this week, Degenerates. If you're presently tying up FG knots for your float and fly session tomorrow, I say a little drip of super glue on the finishing wraps never hurt anyone. That's what I would say. I would also say, please keep sending in your questions, bar nominations, awkward photos, sailbin items, and whatever else you think up to bent@themeateater.com.
Yep, and don't forget,
use those degenerate angler hashtags.
Yes.
You know, we see all those posts and, you know, I don't know, we like checking up on what you're into. So, you know, it's good when I'm at the office and I want to slack a little bit.
There you go. Yes, we do love seeing that. And finally, hey, keep in mind that knot tying tools are for the weak, and God gave you teeth so you wouldn't have to buy $200 tungsten carbide nail clippers.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.